And I'm from Olympia, Washington. And I met Slam when I was still in high school. Anyways, we'll go on the history later. But anyways, I was in a band called Bratmobile, singing in it, which was an early band on Kill Rock Stars. We were on the original comp. And later was in a band, Cold Cold Hearts, also on Kill Rock Stars. And then Deep Lust, also on Kill Rock Stars. And then I've been in other bands since then, Bratmobile again, Party Line, Cool Moms in LA, Sex Stains, X Stains, and a band with Alice Bag, a kind of project thing with Seth Bogart and Alice Bag called Clicky Bitches or Scorpio Scorpio. We changed our name every show we had. But also, I ended up going back to school so I could do kind of arts journalism stuff and focusing on audio. So I did a podcast for a year for Tidal streaming service, and it's called I'm In the Band. In, not with. And so many people confuse it. I was like, no, that's Pamela's thing. And it was, you know, the whole point was to focus on marginalized musicians, basically, and underrepresented artists. And I'm reviving it now, again, through a fellowship, which will it'll just be on my own website and stuff. And, yeah, I'm not in a band right now. It's the longest time I've not been in a band.
Oh, really?
Okay. And I did a fanzine, Girl Germs. Oh, Riot Girl, forgot about that. You know, stuff like that. Lady Fest. I didn't do all the work for that, but I did coin the term, and I was
Lady Fest.
Riot Girl was kind of through. It was more Toby and Jen Smith, but and we kind of put the words together. But anyways, but yeah, whatever.
Steph, do you okay? Yeah. Can you want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. My name's Stephanie Phillips. I play in a band called Big Joni, which is a black feminist punk band from London in the UK, and we're going to be releasing our next album this year on Kill Rock Stars, so that's why I'm on the label. I also am an organiser at a festival called Decolonise Fest, which is an annual festival that promotes people of colour in the punk scene, and so we put on an annual festival in London. And I'm also a music journalist and writer, and released a book called Why Solange Matters, which was out on the University of Texas Press here as well. So,
Thanks.
Oh God, it's my turn. Hi, I'm Shamir. I'm a musician. I sing and play guitar and write songs and stuff like that. But aside from that, it's a little known fact that, well, not little known, it's a new label called Accidental Pop Stars. And I launched it back in 2018, and we're now 6 releases in, I believe. And, Kill Rock Stars invite us to do the official showcase with them for tomorrow. And, aside from that, I produce for other artists and basically, I guess, more so about Accidental Pop Star. It's more of like a artist development situation, as opposed to kind of like a real label, in the sense that like I only like work with artists that have zero, mostly, previous experience before working with me, and I kind of just help them like, you know, hone their artistry and visuals and like everything, and make sure everything is cohesive, but like in a way that doesn't feel exploitative, because I think that artist development in the music industry is almost obsolete, and I think someone has to do it.
Yeah.
I should have started with me. I thought I was going to get away with not doing a bio because I'm just the moderator, but I guess I should say, I'm Slam. I started Kill Rock Stars, and that was 30 years ago. It was originally supposed to just be a spoken word label, because I felt like there were a couple labels in the Pacific Northwest, and that was enough. And I thought it would be cool to just do spoken word 7 inches. But then all my friends had these great bands, and those few labels in the Pacific Northwest were ignoring them. So I felt like I had to step up, and that's really how we got started. And okay, let's think of something. So,
what about your bands?
Oh yeah, and I was in some bands. I was in before Kill Rock Stars. I was in Eights and Aces, Nisqually Delta Pony Nightmare.
Yes.
Lush, Witchy Poo, and no Earth, and then Witchy Poo. And a couple little teeny bands that only played a couple shows. Like I was in Wacky Dentist Pals with Donna, with Toby Vail, and I was in Slim and Grim with Donna Dresch. And then my most recent band that technically still exists but nobody realizes still exists is called Slim Moon and Wet Army. But we haven't played a show in like 12 years because nobody knows we exist, so they haven't asked us to play. I swear I had some good ideas for what we were going to talk about. Okay.
What about talking about how everyone kind of gravitated or came to Kill Rock Stars? The label. Or the idea.
Sure. So Allison, let's talk about, I was thinking about 91 and like what a seismic year it was for Olympia and for the punk scene that we were a part of that had tentacles not just in Olympia but in like the East Bay and in DC, and then Nirvana's record came out and there was this big change in mainstream rock and Riot Grrrl started, and I was especially thinking of like the Kill Rock Stars compilation, the first rock compilation we came out, we threw it together really fast in order to sell copies at this thing called the International Pop Underground Convention. And K Records had invited people from all over the world, like bands from several countries and from all over the US to come play, and invited their customers, because they had a mail order business as well as a record label, they invited their customers to come play. And just before that convention started, that it was really like you would think of it as a festival, but they always called it a convention. Just before it started, they threw on an extra night the night before it had been scheduled to start, which they sort of called Girl Night. And you guys played, but Bratmobile played, and
I think we're the only band that played the convention twice.
Yeah,
but it's a good thing we played Girl Night because our official time was like 9 in the morning on a weekday.
But then,
yeah. For the real show.
Do you remember who else played?
I was wearing a shirt.
Okay.
Yeah.
Everybody, this is Cindy. She's Allison's twin. do you remember who played?
Well, it was so early because you guys couldn't even come because it was so early. You were at your SAT or GRE or something like that.
The official show.
But you played Girl Night.
Bratmobile played. You played?
Yeah. With Allison.
Heavens to Betsy played. Bikini Kill play?
Wonder Twins or something like that. And I think Seven Year Bitch played.
Right,
yeah.
7 Year Bitch played. And it was really obviously, hands down, by far, the best show of the festival. Even though Billy Childish was there and Fugazi was there and Nation of Ulysses was there, and it was. I think it really changed lives, you know? And it was like the first time most of us had seen Heavens to Betsy, for instance, had seen Corinne Tucker's big voice, and she was still in high school or whatever. And that was a really big influence on me. Like, up to that moment, and putting together that compilation, it was really just like, I want to put out my friend's records. But that Girl Night really helped change the focus of Kill Rock Stars going forward, because it was so powerful. And it was so time, you know? Yeah. So do you have more to say about that?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I think it was supposed to be the point of Girl Night was to like kind of just challenge things. I mean, I don't know, like it was a challenge to be like, let's try to have only women or whatever, or identifying like, okay, not cis men. And on stage, although I think Tim Green was on that stage all night. But but in general, to challenge people to, even if you're not in a group with all women, to just come up with something just to play for Girl Night, you know, but to challenge people to kind of come up with new ways of working together and things like that. And and kind of one-offs and project bands and things like that. And I believe it was Heavens to Betsy's first show, or at least first show that I knew of. And everyone was crying when Heavens to Betsy played, I know that. Because, you know, we'd seen Corin, or I'd known her since high school. I went to Y Camp with her. but yeah, I think it was the most influential night, it seems like. And everybody was so inspired by each other. And then you were starting the label already with, weren't you passing out your compilation record
at the... We started selling the compilation, not that night, because we didn't have it. The silk screens didn't dry until the next day. Mm-hmm. So we didn't start selling it until the next evening.
Okay.
We had the records, but we didn't have the covers until the second day of the convention.
Right. And the back covers were blank, I remember. And so we would pass the records around and have our friends draw on the back. So my original one has Jeremy Blake drawing on the back or something. So I don't know. It was fun to do that.
So. And then how or why, in your words or in your memory, did Bratmobile end up putting on Kill Rock Stars and putting out records on Kill Rock Stars? Because you guys had a couple choices, right? There were some other labels.
Well, we already had, I think, some maybe split 7 inches out, like on Homestead and K, actually, I think, or at least they were about to come out or something. I remember when Bratmobile played our first show, it was Valentine's Day 1991, and it was opening for Bikini Kill and Sun Velvet Sidewalk. And we had to just put everything together. We were going around, you know, bragging and saying we were a band for probably at least a year. But we didn't really. And we had some kind of poem songs or something like that. Molly was, you know, taking guitar lessons or something like that, bought a guitar. Whatever. And then Calvin Johnson from K challenged us to be like, okay, come up and play this show on Valentine's Day. And we were like, what? We're not a band. And he's like, you're always coming up to Olympia and saying you're a band. And we're like, yeah, well, that's just so we could be cool and hang out. Anyways, and so then we're like, oh, fuck, you know, we got to do this. And then there was this band in Eugene. We were living in Eugene, going to U of O at the time, and we'd go up to Olympia a lot. This band, Oswald 5-0 there, they loaned us their equipment, their practice space, and we just kind of had to write songs. I asked, how do we write a song even? And Robert Christie from that band, from Oswald 5-0, was like, oh, just listen to some Ramones records. Yeah, I didn't have any Ramones records. But I just was like, oh, I'm never going to listen to the Ramones because I want to sound different. Not like we even knew how to sound like the Ramones at the time. But so I still don't have a Ramones record or anything. And then I think Molly bought a car out of the paper for like a couple $100 to get us to the show. So we play this first show up there. When we show up, Corin Tucker's there going to school at Evergreen and asked to interview us. She wasn't in a band yet, I don't think. Well, she wasn't yet in Heavens to Betsy. And I just remember being on stage that first show and wondering, are these songs? Are we a band? Does this count? Does this work? And just being completely like, oh my God, what am I doing up here? But we had all these DIY people from Olympia cheering us on and supporting us. And I look back to that and think, like, how on earth could we have done it in any other place or with any other scene? Like, I don't know. Like, you have Kathleen and whoever up front going, yeah. And, I mean, and then as soon as we go off stage, Slim walks up to us and says, that song, Girl Germs, I want that song. And I'm like, for what? And he's like, a compilation I'm going to do. Okay. I mean, I didn't pay much attention to it, but he did it by, you know, like, what, half a year later or something. Mm-hmm. So, and then we got asked to record with Pat Malley that weekend, and we couldn't even keep a beat to record. Anyways, but we did, I guess. So it was just crazy how quickly things happened. And we had fans, and we brought our first Girl Germs issue to the show. I remember Kurt Cobain walked in right after we got finished, and I jumped off stage and handed him a fanzine. And I was like, you missed our show! And he's like, I'm sorry. But it was just so exciting, and things just really moved from there. So, but that's how I remember getting on Kill Rock Stars, sort of.
I moved to Olympia in 86, and Kill Rock Stars started in 91. And those 5 years that I was there, like the scene I moved into had two reputations. It had like incredibly talented people who were doing really courageous and like against the grain work in art and music and commerce, even like Girls Town was this store that only sold things made by women, and but it also had this snooty elitist reputation that it was kind of hard to break into the scene. And what I found out was that if you contributed, if you did a zine, or you put on shows, or you made records, or you scheduled cakewalks, you could easily be in the scene, and you would get so much support and encouragement. But if you were just sort of a passive consumer who came to shows, you could feel really left out. And I feel like when Kill Rockstar started and the bands, like, I got so much support from that super supportive scene, and I feel like the bands did, and we had the courage to do things differently. When the bands in Seattle, all the people I knew from Seattle were like, if you don't have a bass player, you're not a real band. Mm-hmm. And we were like, if you have a bass player, you're just following the, you're just a sheep, you know?
Well, you don't have room for the bass amp to tour, yeah. I'm saying.
And so, but then when Kill Rockstar, I think it's safe to say as Kill Rockstars grew and started to do bands from elsewhere that wasn't just from Olympia, we tried to have a sense of community. I tried really hard, sometimes annoyingly, I think sometimes inappropriately, but I tried really hard to get all the bands to have a sense of community with each other. And so, Steph, you told me that you started listening to La Tigra and that led you to Kill Rockstars.
Yeah.
Did, from the outside, did it seem like there was a sense of community? Was it just that the music was good, or did it seem like we collectively, the label, stood for something?
Yeah, I think that's kind of like an interesting point. So I think when I was about 16, I saw like a review of La Tigra in NME or Kerrang or one of those places. And I grew up in a place called Wolverhampton in the UK, which is like a small city, and there's not much going on there at all. So like hearing about this whole scene, and then kind of then going on the Kill Rockstar site and finding Bikini Kill, and I found Slater Kinney and Heavens to Betsy and Bratmobile, and kind of just went down a whole Kill Rockstars rabbit hole, and that kind of lasted through my whole teenage years until today. But I got into it so much because it seemed like this whole other world that was kind of more than just the music. Like, the music was really amazing to me, but there was also the kind of the politics around it. That was my first introduction to feminism, really, and my first introduction to kind of the idea of being a political being and kind of encompassing that in your music, and the idea of community and the idea of kind of DIY, being able to create something and not just consume something was really revolutionary. I think especially as like, as kind of being a Black British girl, a teenager growing up in the UK, like it feels very restrictive in terms of kind of what you're supposed to do or what you're told to do, and having this space where you can kind of be anything was like completely revolutionary to me. So it was kind of like that community of Kill Rockstars that I think has kind of was really influential. I think I can see how it influenced kind of like the London punk scene that I came of age in. Like a lot of kind of what you were saying, kind of, you know, your first show at the International Pop Star Underground, like that was kind of like one of my first shows that we played at the London DIY scene. And I actually got involved in the punk scene through Ladyfest. We did a Ladyfest in London in 2010, and that's how I met all those bands there, and how I started playing my first band, and kind of being in the punk scene. So it was just kind of that same ethos, really. And I think that's kind of the most amazing thing about Kill Rockstars, because it has such a long legacy, because there's so much that you can do around that kind of concept of just kind of being your own person and kind of creating around that.
So, Shimi, you told me
we didn't need to clap.
Well put.
We didn't get much of a chance to talk before this, but you said that Unwound got you through depression.
Yeah. Well, you know, I was so frazzled when we talked earlier, but like, yeah, I mean, you know, Kill Rockstars has always been around me peripherally. Starting off, like in high school, like one of my absolute favorite bands was Grass Widow, and you know, they're a huge inspiration to me. But I didn't know about Unwound a bit until like later in life. But in between that time, I found On the Wild in 2016, but in between that time, I don't know how much people know about my story, but I was on this weird trajectory to basically become like a weirdo queer like electro pop star when I was like 19, and I hated it. But before that, I was in a feminist punk band called Anorexia in North Las Vegas. When I was like 16, we played our first South By when we were like 18, still seniors in high school. We had to take like time off of school, but our biggest supporters was like the Pacific Northwest, like feminist scene. We got like interviewed by like She Shreds. It was like our first time I ever did an interview, because it was before like my solo career took off. And so like that energy was like always around. And then when I was in the midst of my solo career, I saw Cedar Kinney live, and I was like, I need to pick the guitar back up. I can't do this anymore. And then that led to me working I picked up guitar, and then I started making guitar music, and everyone was scared. And then led to me working with Maggie Ville. And and then I've just been kind of like chugging along ever since. But the Unwound situation was I had just finished the cycle of like my electro pop era, and I was just so just not great. I was like, I'm glad this is over, but like I don't feel accomplished, and this is probably the most accomplished I'm ever going to be in my life. And I was at the record booth at my last Pitchfork Festival. I had played both years back-to-back in a row, 2015, 2016, and this was in 2016. And I was just, like, talking to, like, this guy in the record booth about bands and my influences and things that I like. And he was like, okay, buy this Unwound box set. And I was like, okay. And it sat in the corner of my room for about 3 months, and I did as well. And I was like, well, let me throw it on. And yeah, immediately that's when it just kind of clicked for me that like I knew that A, I'm going to pick the guitar back up, and like B, like I don't know, I felt like I had found myself again, and like I knew where to go and like how to start again writing guitar music. And yeah, it was a beautiful, life-changing experience, and I don't think I would be here if I, in the midst of my depression slump, throw that record on.
Wow. It's awkward me being the moderator of this panel, because I feel like I came to this before, like, thinking about this panel, putting it together. And then now I'm still having these feelings like I'm probably coming off as like just self-congratulatory, like it's just a celebration of
Kiarsa. It is.
Well, thank you. But I think like when I named it Kill Rock Stars, I remember specifically saying this one thing, which was that so many people thought the only musical option for them was, do I like the hard rock bands on MTV or do I like the pop bands on MTV? And we didn't want to literally kill rock stars, but we wanted to kill like rock stars being your only choice, and all of the consumerism and the distance between the fan and the artist that represented. And so we consciously wanted to have a positive effect on the culture that we were a part of. And I feel like many of our bands, really consciously felt that way too in their motives. And we worked with a bunch of bands that were either labeled Riot Girl or self-identified as Riot Girl, and that was certainly very consciously trying to have a positive effect on culture. So I guess the 15 years of having a chronic illness and facing my mortality and being in my 50s, I look back and it's like become the time when we ask ourselves, have we had a positive effect on the culture? And I was away from music entirely for 8 years. I went back to grad school and everything. So when I came back, there were some big surprises for me. Like in independent labels and in the mainstream, there's more queer artists. There are far more women leading bands. Like, some things are better and different, but some other things are just as bad as they ever were, you know? And but I guess that's the... Even if it's self-congratulatory, I think we have to acknowledge that we have had a positive effect on the culture, because what's the point of this if it's not to say to you folks that what you do can have a positive effect on the culture that you're enmeshed in and that you're participating in?
Yeah, I think I can definitely see that, especially kind of even looking. I got involved in the punk scene about 10 years ago, and the change from how it was then to now has been kind of immense. And kind of having seen kind of like the Riot Girl resurgence of like teens getting into Riot Girl now, and how much it's been kind of taken in on the pop culture. And you know, I can't remember what that Amy Poehler Netflix movie was.
Oh, Moxie.
Moxie. But that's like a whole movie based around a Bikini Kill song, which is really cute. It's like, but it's just such a nice kind of interesting way to see how the culture changes. And that, you know, before, the idea of a feminist punk band was kind of so controversial that it wasn't really covered as much. But now that's kind of almost mainstream and can be kind of like a big part of kind of a teenager's kind of upbringing, kind of just general lifestyle. Just, it's not that kind of out there.
And don't get me wrong, I'm not saying Kill Rock Stars caused all these changes to happen. I'm saying we were a part of it. Where, you know, it's certainly community and like the aggregate effect of lots of people having little effects on the people around them or on the people who they touch is what I mean. But I feel like we've been a part of it. Do either of you want to say anything?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, I feel like I'm a direct descendant, you know what I mean, of the work you did 30 years ago when I was still, I'm not going to say this. I was going to say when I was still swimming in my father's ball sack, and I don't... I was telling my man on our drive here about when I got drunk and high with my dad and my best friends, and he said that, and it was just like, why? But yeah, like, I, you know, a lot of the artists on, especially like, you know, Tigre growing up, like, you know, as a queer person doing kind of like guitar-paced music, like, it certainly in the mainstream was like, hard to find that kind of like representation and kind of like, yeah, more kind of like classic like fringe labels like Kill Rock Stars, kind of like I knew I could find something, you know what I mean? And also just like I said, now as I start my label, you know, I like love to get to, you know, talk to him and work with him and just kind of like think like long term too, because I hope that like I will be in this position, and someone who was inspired 30 years later is also sitting next to me and, you know, saying accidental pop star made me dye my hair orange. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, can I say something?
Yeah, yes, please.
I think, I mean, I totally get what you're saying. Like, sometimes you're just like, because I know nothing was perfect and there's a lot of issues and, you know, there needs to be more intersectionality and everything and a lot of the stuff we've been involved in. But I think you're right. It's that idea of just having even just like the DIY-ness and community aspect and being a participant in your own culture, like what you said, cultural activism, all that. And people just taking a grain of an idea and running with it and making it speak to their own situations, communities, whatever. But I think that's really important. But I also want to say that people like you and some of you out there like influence and inspire us. And that it doesn't have to be just a generational thing or whatever. Like, what inspires me to keep going? You know, Shamir, Big Joni, Downtown Boys, you know, all this stuff like that. Because, you know, we're not dead yet. And I want to try to keep being in bands, but, like, sometimes you're just like, why does anyone care? And then I see things that matter, like what you're doing,
Absolutely. What
you're doing, you know.
No, to piggyback off of that, yeah, that's how I feel, like, in a very, very, very smaller way with, like, you know, accidental pop stars and, like, you know, even though I'm, like, a baby millennial and they're, like, you know, Gen Z, I still feel the divide. And I, you know, I'm constantly so inspired by them. Like, you know, a lot of people are like, you know, you have your career and like you're self-managing your career and you're like doing this label and like everything. And like, aren't you tired? And I'm like, no, because like the work that I do working with other artists, creating community, inspires me so much that in turn, I'm able to have more creative output because I'm literally constantly in a state of being inspired. And another thing about me is that, you know, I'm currently in my 8th album cycle and I write so much. And that's because I'm constantly in the state of like being inspired. And that only kind of like kicked off when I started the label in like 2018, because like in 2018, I think I only had like 3 albums out by then. But then once I started like building this community and working with other artists and everything, like, again, constant inspiration. And I don't think that I would be able to continue my own solo career as it is now if I wasn't also doing a label.
When you described about working with artists who are just starting out and being involved in their development, mm-hmm. I'm like, my feelings were so mixed as you were saying that, because mm-hmm. like part of me is like, I'm so jealous, right? Because that's, I mean, I'm still doing it. Like, I like mm-hmm. to work, you know, regularly with people who are early in their careers, just finding mm-hmm. out what they're capable of, mm-hmm. helping them realize their vision, or even realize that their vision can be bigger. Mm-hmm. But I'm also like terrified for you because it's mm-hmm. in the current economic, like mm-hmm. the way, the model of the music business, mm-hmm. there's a reason that even labels that used to be all...
It's expensive.
All inspiration and yeah. development are now all just analytics and...
Oh, well, you know, I don't mean on that. The end of things. I mean more so that, like, yeah, just kind of like restructuring kind of like the way the artists like think about things. And it's from my experience, you know, starting off when I was like 19 and needing to be developed, you know, as opposed of being milked of my talent, basically. And by, you know, the end of my debut, you know, I don't, like, I have no knowledge, basically. Luckily, I had a bit of an initiative to learn along the way. And so my first record, I came out on XL Recordings, and I told them that I would not sign unless they let me intern. mm-hmm. And that was kind of like when I first learned a lot of things. And then from then on, I ended up, that's when I first came to Philly. And I also, I'm based in Philly. Axel and the Popstars based in Philly. And I found this band called Joy Again, who is now very popular. And they were just literally still in high school. I remember having to wait till they got out of class, and then we headed to like the basement show. And I was like, I don't know what I'm doing, but I have an internship and I'm learning things, and like, you know, let me manage you. But when it was kind of like in the form of like managing, or I guess more on the managerial end of things, I was like so horrible, but kind of like, the way they were organized as a band and aesthetically and finding, you know, producers for them to work with and like everything, that worked out. And they eventually ended up releasing a single with Mom and Pop and Lucky Number in the UK. And once I kind of like later on realized what I did, I was like, oh, I don't want to be a manager. I want to, like, I'm an artist developer. Like, I developed them, but like I don't want to answer emails. So that's kind of like how I came up with the concept of Accidental Pop Star. And that only came about when I was producing for two artists, and I was going to shop one an artist, and then when I produced a second artist, I was like, I don't want to shop two records, so I'll just release them.
Yeah. Just talk about what Allison said, just like talk about inspiring. That is really inspiring to me. Yeah. I'm really excited about that.
Can I ask something? How are we doing on time? I just didn't know when we should open up to Q&A.
Yeah, I was sort of running out of steam, so maybe Q&A is perfect. But Steph, did you want to say anything more before we do?
No. I lost my train of thought.
Okay. Do you guys have any questions? Sure. I guess there's a mic.
Oh, yeah, there's a mic.
Oh, if you want to walk up or... Oh, in the front, it's standing there.
How do these things work? I'm just curious, Steph, about the DIY experience, the DIY culture in the UK punk scene, like in the scene that you came from. I'd just like to hear more about that.
Sure. So actually, the DIY punk scene that I came from, I came to London around 2009 or 2010, and it was more or less kind of based on what you guys were doing. Kind of back in the early 90s, there was a lot of kind of influence from Bikini Kill, from Bratmobile, from kind of all of the kind of Riot Girl and Kill Rockstars bands. So it was very DIY, it was kind of very female-led, very queer, and was kind of more about kind of just punk and kind of creating your own scene and kind of creating your own kind of outlet. So back then, I felt like the punk scene was like very creative and people were in like 5 different bands and kind of playing shows every now and again. Mm. And there aren't like basement shows in the UK because we don't have basements.
Yeah.
but there are kind of like, you know, bar shows and kind of like just weird space. I think the first Big Joni show we played was in a squat in East London that we got kicked out of after a while. But yeah, I mean, it was quite based on kind of like that Riot Girl scene and was really influential for me, and I don't think I would have created a band anywhere else because there was just so much space to just be who you wanted to be, and I don't think you play. There was never a sense where you play a show and a band would get booed or anything like that. It was very kind of welcoming and very informative. And Big Joni's first show was playing for an event called First Timers, which was about kind of getting more marginalised people into the punk scene. So. You had to kind of form a band, and then hopefully everyone was playing something new. So in Big Joni, Shadeen was playing drums for the first time. I was singing for the first time. Our original bassist, Kira, was playing bass for the first time. And we just kind of got our songs together and got ready to play the first time as events, which was like the first time we play. And that's what happened. I think about 10 bands played over that weekend, and they do them kind of every year. So I think it's one this year, I think. So it's kind of about getting more people into bands. And so that kind of ethos and that kind of spirit is just about, you know, creating a space for people to just kind of be as creative as they possibly can, or just making sure people that know that creativity is a possibility. So, yeah.
Anybody else have questions?
Can I ask more about the UK? Oh, sorry.
Oh, yeah.
We can hear you.
Nobody's gonna make you go to the mic. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Was there something called power? Yes.
I was just so deflated from everything that I had been through before, and I was like, I have to do this again. I don't know about that. So, you know, another big kind of like canon moment in my life is like, mental illness. I tried to actually do another kind of like a pop-ish situation, but a little bit more like alternative leaning, to kind of try to like compromise. And there was kind of like another like kind of like internal conflict with the producer that I was working with. And that was my second try at a sophomore record, and so I, when that fell through again for the second time, I was like, this feels like a sign. Like, I'm trying to do what they want me to do, but it's not working out. So when that fell through, I kind of, you know, I wrote and released this album called Hope through a manic episode, and recorded it on my four track and over a weekend, threw it up on SoundCloud on a Monday. And yeah, it was just so stark from like the shiny, glimmery, you know, electro pop. And here's me manically screaming through a four track with my guitar and covering like babies. That's where Accidental Pop Star Records title comes from, because I, in the description on SoundCloud, the first line in my little description is, from day one it was clear that I was an accidental pop star. I believe that, you know what I mean? I wear that as a badge of pride. Like, I should have never been a pop star. But this is where I am, so I've just learned to make it work for me.
Shadeen from Big Joni.
Just wanted to ask about where you feel Kill Rock Stars is as a label in the current industry, where we're seeing, I guess, majors kind of create these kind of fake independents as a sort of authenticity thing for new bands. So I'm just wondering what the panel's opinion is on that, because we are at like a major music industry showcase. So
can I just say that I hate the concept of indie music as a genre. It makes me want to crawl out of my skin. It's horrible. Huh?
Why is that, do you think?
Because as she mentioned, it's like now a commodifiable thing as opposed to a description of how someone is navigating their career. Now it's a sound.
Yeah, I see.
I meant it in that way. Love indie music. Artists, you know what I mean? Real independent artists, not someone who has like a major label backing and wants to create an authentic sound. We are in the gutter of capitalism. It is dark. And as someone who's starting an independent label in very late stages of capitalism, it is hard. Because the thing about me is that I want us to present in a way that looks like we have a budget. I do everything myself. I self-distribute. I ship all the records out by myself. I will direct and shoot a video if I need to, because if we don't have money to hire someone or someone doesn't want to do for a favor, I will shoot my artist. I style my artist. I style Grant Pavel, who's playing tomorrow. I do it all myself to make sure that it looks like it might be a budget, because now people won't even pay attention to it if it doesn't, because now people think independent still has budgets because of the indie artists on major labels, and it's hard.
Yeah, I think it's like an interesting scenario, because there's only so much room for what is considered indie as well and what's considered alternative, and anything that's not, you know, straight, white, cis men, at least in the UK, is kind of pushed to the side. Or if you are kind of black, you have to kind of fit within the white mainstream's idea of what you create. So,
or they try to exploit your identity.
Or they try to exploit your identity, so yeah. I mean, we've had so many instances where people kind of know that we're like a black feminist punk band and then think that our songs are all going to be about, like, you know,
oppression
or like fuck the white man. It's like, well, no, who cares about them? Do you know what I mean? Not in like a bad way, but like, we're not going to spend our time writing songs about white people.
Yeah.
White people get so much time in their daily life anyway. Like, if we're going to be in a room together as black women, and especially because there's never really a space where you can be all black women in a space, or, you know, have that kind of time to yourself, you're going to think about yourself, and you're going to think about your community and create things like that. So, yeah, I think just creating more space for yourself can be quite hard within the way the industry is structured at the moment.
I want to hear how you feel. I'm really interested.
Well, being 30 years old, we have the benefit that we have put out 600 records and we have income coming from the popular ones of those records. Some of the records, you know, all our early deals were handshakes and the band, it was at will, the band could leave whenever they want, and some of those bands have chosen to leave and either gotten a big advance from another label or self-released. And but we have this money that makes it possible for us to keep going. It would be really, really hard to make the choices we're making and do what we're doing right now without the income coming from things that we did in the 90s, you know, that's still carrying over. When you ask that question, one thing it made me feel or think about was, like, the way capitalism goes, it's not independent. Some of the independent labels have gotten so large that they just behave like the majors. Like they're guilty of all the same things that have been problems with majors all along.
Cough. XL Recordings. Cough.
And this is really like patting myself on the back, but it's just a truth that at various stages, including leaving the label for 13 years and coming back, but also at various stages, I saw those moments when I had to make decisions that some of my peers made that would make us more commercially secure, but would eat away at why we started a label in the first place. And we've made some compromises. Like, I don't want to say we're completely uncompromising. Like, I to some degree, I always saw my job as being a midpoint between capitalist reality and the visions of the artists. So I've asked people to make compromises before, but many times we've made the decision that was not the smart economic decision. And you know, some of my peers who were in the same place 20 years ago are now millionaires, but the work they're doing seems pointless to me, you know? And I'm very happy with the decisions that we've made and the label, what Kiroxers is doing now. And we're especially really leaning into our identity as a queer label these days. And that's where all of us, the six of us who are running the label now, I think it's not every band, but it's a big part of our identity, and so I feel like we're still trying to have the right reasons and the similar reasons, but relevant to 2022 for how we started. We're not trying to get rich. We're just trying to keep doing what we're doing with some compromises in order to be able to keep doing it, and then a lot of refusing to compromise.
But that does work out in the end, I think. Like, there are so many instances where you see bands or kind of labels making too many compromises, and it just kind of makes them look, it just kind of ruins kind of their image or kind of what they're supposed to stand for. So if you kind of keep your legacy and keep your kind of ideals, it can kind of keep you going for, you know, possibly decades longer than it would do otherwise if you took that deal or took kind of that major label sponsorship. Or, you know, sometimes you just have to kind of turn down the money, even though kind of need money to pay the rent. But, like, sometimes you do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think in late-stage capitalism, like, the biggest thing that you have to, like, hold true to is your values. Because, like, at the end of the day, you know, there's no, you know, honorable consumption under capitalism. Like, we're all victims, you know what I mean? And sometimes, you know, you do have to make those compromises. But then there's those compromises that it's like, you know you couldn't sleep at night about it, you know what I mean? And that, and if you can sleep at night about it, don't do it, you know what I mean? I have a song that gets a lot of syncs, and that's basically what funds my label. And, you know, one time I got McDonald's, and I said, absolutely fuck no, you know what I mean? Like, I just wouldn't be able to sleep with myself after that. But, like, I'll take Android. You know what I mean? Like, you know what I mean? It's just not too much better, but at least I can, like, sleep with myself after that. So that's just kind of, like, what I go by, just, like, just really stay true with my values, and if it feels like it compromised my values, then it's no.
Can I just say I've never been offered any of that shit? I also want to put it out there that sometimes your values are what you know, what's going on, what you're being offered. And maybe I punk damage in a downward trajectory, but we've never even been offered any of that shit. I haven't been offered anything I turned down.
What should be fair?
I'm not just saying you. I'm not going to be like. I just want to keep the idea out there that sometimes in our scenes and stuff, there's a lot of times when the mainstream has never seen what you're doing as commercially viable. So you just don't even have the option to sell out.
Yeah, no, I always tell people, I'm like, sell out in the beginning like I did.
Uh-huh.
And then, like,
give me a tampon commercial.
Right. Yeah. But Allison, I've been, what happens to most people who never have any of those like, sort of big break situations, they never get any, it never really makes that much money for them, is that by the time they're our age, they're like a lawyer or they manage a store. Mm-hmm. Like the fact that you're still you're still living a life devoted to art is like your version of not taking the money. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I don't want to say oh poor me because I actually still get royalties off the first record on Kill Rock Stars, and that's pretty much the only place it comes from. At the same time, it's like, wow, you know, that record cost us like $40 for the reel and like a box of hair dye and a pizza. So I'm not saying like, oh, woe is me, exactly, but it's just interesting that, you know, maybe also I'm just not caught up with the modern age, but I don't even know how to kind of, sometimes I just don't even know what's available out there. I have no idea what I could be offered or what is, you know, I don't know. That's true, thanks to these guys.
It's not that far away, so if you think you're not selling, if you think you're like, oh, no one will see me selling out in Canada, it's not true. A big, you know, like company in Canada that has monopoly on stuff, and yeah, the team for a commercial, commercial, like I thought.
You can still sell out.
We've been offered things that someone else in my band said no to and I never even heard about. So,
maybe.
Who knows?
I think it's interesting, how kind of like the industry's changed because I think like now it's more likely that bands are going to be pushed on kind of like brand sponsorships and kind of deals and syncing because there's so much less money in kind of selling albums or definitely touring after the last 2 years. So kind of that's why like syncing and like all those kind of like being offered, you know, our band gets offered to do different kind of shows or deals to promote a particular brand, but it's just like, that's not really worth it. But that's where most bands get their money.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's just kind of a change of the industry, really.
Mm-hmm. In the 90s, a lot of our bands turned a lot of syncs down.
Yeah.
But they were doing okay getting money from someplace else.
Yeah.
And where the reasonable line was moved as they made less and less money from record sales. And a lot bands are much more likely to say yes to a sync or take a corporate sponsorship now because there's almost no other way to finance what they're doing.
Yeah.
And it's funny because like basically my entire career, like it was already kind of like, you know, known. It was basically like canon that like, seldomly say no to a sync, you know what I mean? Because like that is where the money is, you know, like back then people were like, money's in touring, but like when I started it was always like money's in syncs, you know. So
well, I also think it's, well, I don't know, I I think that just because there's visibility or just because you're the face of, say, a festival or whatever like that doesn't necessarily mean the money's there. Like, I have a lot of people I've interviewed for my podcast have said that their image has been used to promote things that they're doing or playing or whatever, but they're still not getting paid as much as, like, the cis straight white men bands. On any festival or any type, even with Sinks or whatever, I think. And it's like, sometimes you just don't even know what to ask for because you've never seen that kind of money. But these, you know, and I know it's not just about what you ask for. Well, you don't get it if you don't ask for it. It's like, guess what? You don't get it when you ask for it, too. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're not, you know. So it's what you don't even know what to ask for, but even when you do, you often don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Because they already see us as a risk to work with automatically.
Yeah. Well, I can't like being a risk.
Obviously, yeah, definitely in some ways I like being a risk, but like, you know, definitely like, well, yeah, but it's more so like being like a risk just like by default, you know, not yeah, because you're like, you know, edgy or like punk or like whatever, just like, oh, this is a black queer artist.
Yeah,
you know,
steer away.
Yeah, or it's like we're already sticking our neck out for you.
Yeah, so they'll just put another four straight white men in a band on, I mean, I think we've had that for so long with Big Journey because I mean we've been going for like nearly 10 years now as a band, and it's taken so long to get any progress because it's so hard to kind of get anyone to kind of realise what we're doing in terms of kind of being black women in a punk band. It's just seen kind of outside of the mainstream, so if you're not kind of doing the normal, then it's just kind of like, no, we don't know what to do with you.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think we're...
are we done?
Yeah.
Are we done?
Let's
okay, perfect.
Now. Quick question.
Well, thank you all for coming and for the good question.
I want these.
Yeah.
Nice equipment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.